This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, Mike O'Neill here again. Mike Russell is off doing another show. We dealt with the Supreme Court last week. Paul Bender, former dean of the ASU Law School and longtime Supreme Court watcher, reviewed with us the decisions, the blockbuster, some of them that came down in the last couple of weeks. The court is now out of session, but they have, however, put a lot of. By the way, if you want to listen to that, the KTAR.com has a website that's archived the last couple of shows, and that one will be on there. You go to KTAR. It's a little tricky to get in. You go to KTAR.com, then you have to find a button that says all shows. Then you find the Think Tank, and then you get onto our site. And they have the last couple of shows. It's on the right-hand side once you get to the Think Tank page. There are, however, shows archived back to show one 3 years ago at MikeO'Neill.org. Click on the button that says radio, and you'll see them all there sorted by year. There's also a site, O'NeillResearch.com, has some of our public opinion research, and you can see me at Michael J. O'Neill at Twitter. But we are now going to look forward. We dealt with last year's cases, but there are some blockbuster cases potentially coming up for this year. And we have a different Supreme Court observer, John Hsu, former White House attorney who worked on the confirmation of, I think it was three of the justices. Is that right, John?
Yes, Justices Thomas, Alito, and Roberts.
Okay. Maybe some special insight there if you worked with them. But let's move, if we can. There's several really interesting cases. The court, by the way, I noticed they've said a number of cases that they're going to take that we're going to talk about. Is that list now fixed? Can they add additional cases into next year's agenda?
Oh, yeah. This is the preliminary list of cases that they've granted certiorari, which means that they've taken on the appeals from the appellate court, and they do that on a rolling basis.
And how late can that occur? I mean, is that set by October?
Well, no. They take cases beyond October, but after a certain point, they have to assign it to the next year's term.
Right, right. I meant for this coming year. And the court year starts in October. They're on vacation now till October.
That's right.
And the final decisions come out typically around the end of June. So,
well, they issue decisions all year long, but they typically wait for the blockbuster decisions until June, because by then they're pretty much out of the country and nobody can bother them.
You know, it's interesting. I made that observation with Paul Bender last week that, they hold the blockbuster stuff till the end. He said, no, that isn't true. He said it's the most contentious cases. Maybe those are the same thing, the ones where you have the largest amount of dissents or whatever. But as a lay observer, it surely always seemed to me like most of the really big cases are held to the end.
Well, I think Paul has a good point in the sense that the contentious cases tend to be also the blockbuster cases. That's why they're blockbusters. And when a justice is trying to craft a majority opinion, ideally he tries to get as many justices as he can on board. And so it could come down to just a sentence or two and the very careful crafting of each single sentence. And so it takes a little longer to craft those opinions than it does for a case that's not as contentious.
By the way, this reminds me, I will plug a great old book. If you want to understand the inner workings of the Supreme Court, The Brethren, wonderful. I mean, just the back and forth negotiation. Somebody writes an opinion and then they'll revise it, trying to get one more vote. And it's not like everybody just goes off into their own room and makes a decision. They do a lot of internal court negotiation.
Well, a lot of it is done by memo. And I think one of the problems with The Brethren is that it was written by a former Supreme Court clerk to Justice John Paul Stevens. And it's not clear to me that he maintain the confidentiality of the chambers.
Well, that's probably, if to the extent that he didn't, that's what made it interesting. I mean, you have what is really probably the most secretive part of our entire government, really important stuff going on. And I remember when that book came up, it was like the first time we ever got a peek behind the curtain as to how this actually works.
Well, I think that's one law clerk's point of view.
Yeah.
And I also think that you mentioned the word secretive. I actually don't think it's that secretive in the sense that the Supreme Court is the only branch that has to explain all of its reasoning in public. In other words, the opinion of the majority is made public. The oral arguments are made public in terms of transcript. And then, of course, the dissents are also made public, and their legal reasoning is made public.
Well, absolutely true. I was talking more about the process that precedes that. The first draft of the memo, the changed votes, the all the stuff, all the, sort of like the, it'd be like, legislative analogy would be all, you don't hold, all your hearings are in private and all that. And then you actually have to vote on legislation. Yes, that's public. But how you got there is that's a fascinating, a little off topic, but fascinating. A view of what went on, I don't think there's been any kind of a sequel to that, really, has there?
To the Brethren?
Yeah.
Not that I know
anything
of,
that gave you as much of a sense of what went on inside. That's why it was fascinating, because nobody had ever seen that before. Anyway, abortion. This is not a case that the Supreme Court has agreed to take, but they did something that at least suggests that they might. A little bit of history here is that the state of Texas has passed one or more laws that appear to me to be a backdoor attempt to virtually outlaw abortion. The law they passed says abortion facilities have to be constructed like surgical centers. Doctors have to have admitting privileges in a local hospital. But the practical impact of this is that almost all abortion clinics in the state of Texas would have to close. The court said hold off on that.
Yeah, and that's I think that's one way to look at it. You know, I think the state of Texas would argue that what they're doing is just holding abortion clinics, almost all of which are run by a group called Planned Parenthood, to have the same healthcare standards and the same medical standards as a clinic or a hospital. But you're right, the Supreme Court did put a hold on that, and they also put a hold on a similar law in the state of Mississippi. And I think it's well noting that Mississippi and Texas belong to the same Court of Appeals circuit, which is the Fifth Circuit. And that's probably the most conservative circuit in the country today. But the Supreme Court has put a hold on that. They're not deciding abortion one way or the other. All they're saying is that the state of Mississippi and the state of Texas should just keep things the way they are, the status quo, until further notice.
Well, that's a pretty standard thing for the court to do while something's being adjudicated, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It suggests that there are at least issues that ought to be considered.
Yeah, I mean, they're certainly considering any kind of legal challenges right now, but I think it's standard for the court to say, well, let's just keep things in the status quo until we make our own decision.
Okay. Well, we'll return to that. I will move on for the moment, but I will return to that. And I'll later on want to ask you this question. It's to the flip side of the one that I asked Paul Bender last week. I said, you know, I think a lot of these abortion restriction cases are written by people who really would like to outlaw it and know that they can't do that. Not unlike people who bring the cases like against the three-drug cocktail, saying that that's an unconstitutional application of the death penalty. Their real agenda, I think, is to outlaw the death penalty, but they know they don't have the votes to do that. But that we'll probably get there back in segment four. We want to return with John Hsu in just a minute. We're going to talk about redistricting and affirmative action on the Supreme Court agenda for next year.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we're back with former White House Attorney John Hsu. We're talking about the agenda for next year's Supreme Court cases. There are some blockbuster recurrent topics. One of the most longstanding topics, been around for 30 or 40 years minimum, is the issue of affirmative action. Let's take our time on this one, do a little bit of the history. Backe case was the first big one that I was aware of. You want to give us a short summary of how we got into our current situation?
Sure. The Bakke case, you're right. It was Bakke. It was here in California, and basically the University
UC Davis.
Yeah, and but it applied to the entire University of California system. And the question was, of course, whether they could use race in terms of a pure quota system. And the answer was no.
And Bakke was a white kid who said that, I just fell a little short of your admission criteria. Had I been black, I would have gotten in.
Yeah, but I think that would have applied to anybody, mm-hmm. Regardless of the race. So that was in 1978. In 2002,
did the court say in Bakke?
Well, the court said that race can be used as a compelling state interest in terms of finding a diverse classroom environment, but setting certain quotas for the number of minority students was unconstitutional.
Okay, so it can be a factor, but you can't have a quota.
Right.
That's the nutshell. And then I think the next one that comes to my mind is a more recent case in Michigan.
Right. Well, there are two cases from Michigan. The first case was in 2002, and that case was called Gratz versus Bollinger. And there, the Supreme Court struck down the University of Michigan's point system. The University of Michigan was using an arbitrary point system where they would grant points partially based on race. But they were very clear, points, a number of points that an applicant would receive based on his race. And so the Supreme Court struck that down in 2002, saying that these arbitrary point systems were unconstitutional and requiring a, quote, holistic approach, unquote.
Okay. So at this point, they're sort of constraining affirmative action, but they're not outlawing it.
Well, I think what they're doing is they're certainly following the Bakke precedent and saying that, quotas and arbitrary point systems, hard quotas and hard point systems are roughly equivalent. And so that's why they struck it down in 2002. Now, in 2003, there was another Michigan case. This one came from a law school. And the question was, now Michigan had said, okay, we have to use this holistic approach that the Supreme Court wants. And so we want to know now if we can use race as part of this holistic process, as long as we specifically say that there's not a quota system. And the court upheld that. The court ruled in favor of the University of Michigan. They said it was all right. But that case is very notable because Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, native Arizonan, wrote a very powerful concurring opinion. She agreed with the majority, but she specifically said that she expected that within 25 years of 2003, within 25 years, that race would not need to be used at all.
Okay, we move forward. Now we have a case, Fisher versus the University of Texas. Want to tell us how that fits into this pattern?
Yeah, and so that case came around in 2013, about 2 years ago. And what happened was that a Caucasian student, Abigail Fisher, she applied to the University of Texas at Austin, and she got rejected. Now, Texas has an unusual system in that the top 10% of graduates in all Texas high schools are automatically granted admission into the University of Texas, assuming a sufficient SAT score. And Abigail Fisher was in the top 11%. And she says that there were minority students who ranked below her and who didn't have her extracurriculars and whatnot that were granted admission to the University of Texas and Austin, and she didn't. And so the court took her case. The Fifth Circuit ruled in favor of the University of Texas and its holistic system. But the Supreme Court said, well, we don't think that the Fifth Circuit used the correct standard. The standard that the court wanted the Fifth Circuit to use is something called strict scrutiny, which means that the University of Texas has to prove it has a compelling governmental interest to show diversity in its admissions process. And so the court basically kicked the can down the road.
How do you show a compelling? It seems to me that's a value statement. I mean, essentially, you either believe that it's a good thing or you. How do you prove that?
Well, that's why they pay these Supreme Court attorneys an awful lot of money, because it's not easy. If it were easy, there wouldn't be so many cases before the Supreme Court. It would have been settled a long time ago.
I mean, to me, you either think that having a diverse class is inherently a good thing, or you don't. It just boggles my mind how you could approve that one way or the other.
Well, the diversity in itself can be considered a compelling governmental interest. But if you make that argument, then you have to show that what you did to get there is constitutional as well. For example, you know, in Bakke, you could say that from the 1978 case, you could say that, you know, a diverse class environment is a compelling governmental interest. But if you use hard racial quotas, like the University of California did, or these arbitrary points, like the University of Michigan did in 2002, those are not constitutional ways to get to that diverse classroom environment.
So how is this case different from, say, for example, the Michigan cases?
Well, the 2013 case is different in two ways. First, Michigan, the state of Michigan, did not have this top 10% system that the state of Texas has.
And California has the same system, I believe, doesn't it, for the UC?
I don't think so.
I think
so.
It might be top 5%, but
It's certainly not top 10 here in California. But and then in Texas also, you know, the issue at that case was, did the appellate court below, did the Fifth Circuit use the correct standard? And the Supreme Court said no. It was a 7-1 vote. Justice Kagan had to recuse herself because she had filed briefs on the case when she was in the Solicitor General's office. And so it was a 7-1 vote, and they just sent it back to the Fifth Circuit. But now it's back. Now it's back. We have Fisher versus the University of Texas, Part 2.
Well, I think it's pretty clear that affirmative action has been back in front of the court repeatedly. Every time it's a blockbuster and likely to be so again. We're coming up on a hard break here. We will return with former White House attorney John Hsu in just a minute or so. And we'll talk. We'll move on to redistricting, gerrymandering by race, public sector, labor unions, and other issues.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we are back with constitutional attorney John Hsu. We were talking about affirmative action. There is another redistricting case that has racial overtones on it. And that case has been agreed to be heard by the court in the upcoming term. You want to tell us about that case?
Yeah, I mean, this term, of course, the high court ruled that Arizona's independent commission was constitutional, and that opened the door to this new case, which is called Harris. And here, it's the question of whether the commission itself behaved and acted in the proper way. The question is, of course, the commission is supposed to divide the Arizona's 30 districts into roughly equal numbers, but that hasn't been the case. And the allegation is that the commissions are intentionally packing Republican voters into already Republican districts and are intentionally opening up certain districts to where Democrats have a bigger chance of winning. And then the other issue, of course, is whether these commissions are acting within the constraints of the 1968 Voting Rights Act and diluting minority voting strength, and operating in line with the standard one person, one vote principle.
Well, one of those things, I believe, if I have my sequence right, the commission was established in 2000. They did that election. They did the 2010 redistricting. But when they did the 2010 redistricting, there was this requirement of not diluting minority voting strength of the 68 Voting Rights Act. But the Supreme Court has kind of undercut that criteria. Am I correct?
Well, they actually removed a complete aspect of that criteria, which is something called preclearance.
Yeah.
In the 60s, because of the many abuses that certain states did regarding the voting rights of their minority citizens, the Justice Department required that states had to pre-clear any kind of redistricting with the Justice
Only Department. Some states, and Arizona was one of them. Basically,
Arizona was one of them.
Mostly the states of the Confederacy plus Arizona.
Right. But the Supreme Court removed that very recently, and so the preclearance part of it, I think, it shouldn't be anyway part of the appeal.
But the parts of the 68 law, and tell me if this is still in effect, is thou shalt never dilute minority voting strength in a majority district. Is that still a requirement?
But what happened is that when the Arizona Commission relied on a combination of race and political party affiliation to create a Latino-influenced district, there's a question as to if they disregarded the majority-minority rule. And so that's one of the questions that the Supreme Court is going to have to analyze on this case.
Well, those are if you're talking about PAC districts, there's two of them in the state, and they are Rahul Grijalva's district and the Gallego district, the former Pastor district, which are heavily Hispanic and heavily actually packed not with Republicans but with Democrats. But the effect of that is actually to advantage Republicans, in addition to those two congressmen who have basically guaranteed seats forever. But there are people who are alleging that they're favoring Republicans by packing Republicans into the other districts?
No, it's the other way around, that they're disadvantaging Republicans because they're packing Republican voters into districts that are already heavily Republican. And probably the district that's at highest risk is District LD8, which goes from Casa Grande through Florence and the Valley.
That was Gabriel Gifford's former district, I believe.
From Globe on one side to Oracle, Arizona, and the other.
Which currently, and Martha McSally is the newly elected Republican congressman from that district.
And the problem with that, of course, is that the population is supposed to be around 213,000, and the commission in 2010, when they redistricted, they made it considerably lower than that.
Do you know ballpark how far off? You know, they're supposed to be equal, but it's never been clear to me, you know, equal, does that mean within one vote, or does that mean, what's the...
No. It's off by about 8,000 to 10,000 votes.
Okay.
Yep.
And then the question becomes how, you know, we want districts to be reasonably equal. How close does it have to be?
Well, the courts haven't ever decided it, and I don't think the commission has ever said either. The other factors are supposed to be, besides equal size in terms of... numbers, they're supposed to be, you know, roughly the same shape, and they're supposed to use county boundaries, natural county boundaries, whenever possible. And I don't think the commission has done that.
Yeah.
And so that adds, I think, to the controversy that's before the court.
Yeah, this is interesting. The county boundary thing is very different by state. It's pretty easy, for example, in Iowa, where you've got 99 counties. Well, we've got 13 counties, and some of them are pretty small. So, and a couple are pretty big. You know, 62% of the state is in one county.
Yeah. Well, and the trial court was not particularly friendly to the commission. I mean, the trial court specifically stated that partisanship had played some role in designing the map, which is problematic in and of itself because the commission is supposed to be independent. And then also the trial court noted that the evidence showed that at least two of the five commissioners really hard. They pushed changes to improve Democrat prospects by reducing the Republican population. And like I said, by moving the Republicans into districts that were already heavily Republican.
Mm-hmm. Okay, moving on. Public sector labor unions, can they mandate that their members pay dues for representation?
Well, that's going to be the hot case in terms of labor law next term. And I think the case comes from California. It's Friedrichs versus the California Teachers Association. And it's going to be a very difficult challenge. And I think the Supreme Court had been asking for this case for quite some time. Last year, there was a case called Harris versus Quinn, where a group of Medicaid home health workers were saying that they shouldn't be forced to pay union fees because they really weren't government employees. And so by 5-4, Justice Alito said, yep, you're right. You shouldn't have to be forced to pay the union fees. You certainly can if you want to, but if you don't want to, you shouldn't force that. And what they want to do is they want to reexamine a labor law case from 1977 called Abood versus Detroit Board of Education. And that's really the heart of this case, whether that Abood case is still good law after all these years.
I mean, the flip side of this argument, the labor unions are going to maintain, we need that. If essentially paying these dues is voluntary, everybody will choose to freeload, and basically the unions will be decimated.
Well, that's one of their arguments for sure. Another one of their arguments, of course, is that this case sort of limits itself to public service unions or public sector employee unions, as opposed to like the United Auto Workers or the Electricians Union or something like that. And so the argument is, for a public sector union, any action that the union takes is essentially speech-related, because it's always looking out for interests, and those interests are very tightly wound with political speech. And so we have a situation here in California where even the teachers who opt out of paying agency fees are still charged what's known as the service fee. And those service fees are approximately $600 a year for a part-time teacher and roughly twice that for a full-time teacher.
How do those compare to full union dues?
Well, they're slightly lower, but they're still pretty substantial. Yeah. $1,200 a year is a lot. And plus, with the service fee, the union member who's opted out, he or she has absolutely no say in how that money is being spent.
Well, there's really two parts of union dues, I think, that one could segregate. You're having a certain fraction of union dues is going to representation before your employer. And then there's a stronger objection, is there not, to say, well, unions also spend money on political activities. And if I disagree with what they're doing, then I don't like that's probably easier to kick out the latter part than the former.
Except that in the case of a public sector union, Mike, the situation is if a public sector union is representing its employees in front of the quote employer, the employer is the government, and so in that sense, representing the union members before the government is essentially a free speech action, and so that's why this particular case is so strong. So, I don't think a similar case from a private sector union such as the United Auto Workers, I don't think it would have had the same impact. The fact that it's a public sector union really brings it to the Supreme Court.
I understand that the fact that it's public sector gives it an additional element, but I'm just speculating here. If the court were to say, for example, you can't compel individual employees to pay money to a labor union without their consent, if they were to say that, I wonder if we might see litigation down the road that says, all right, this logic would apply to private sector as well.
Well, it's certainly possible, but I think it would be a lot weaker because it doesn't have the same constitutional power that a public sector union has. And but you never know. And both the private sector unions and the public sector unions would certainly argue that they don't want a bunch of freeloaders taking advantage of the collective bargaining power without having to pay any kind of fee or any kind of union dues.
Well, that's certainly the argument on the other side. And I think as a practical matter, I mean, they're right. I mean, essentially, if you give a lot of people the opportunity to opt out and still get the benefits of the union, then a lot of them are going to take it and, pocket that $1,200 a year or whatever it is.
That's true. But I think the original purpose of the unions, whether they're public sector or private sector, were to protect American workers from any sort of abuses, as opposed to being involved in political campaigns. And the unions are pretty strong in political campaigns. You know, they generally donate tens of millions of dollars to a particular candidate. And obviously, unions have the union members themselves have a very wide and diverse beliefs about a particular candidate or not. And so it's very difficult for a union, I think, to choose to support an individual candidate in the political sphere as opposed to just trying to do their best to stand up for workers' rights in the labor and employment sphere.
Well, of course, you're calling from California. I think the power of the labor unions in California, inarguably, are a lot more than they are in Arizona. Though even within the state of Arizona, I would observe that it's uneven, that the we've had folks in here who've argued that the labor unions run the city of Phoenix. Sal DeCiccio, city councilman, certainly said that. And they clearly have major influence in the city. Not a whole lot. I think it'd be very hard-pressed to show much influence at a statewide level in the state of Arizona. But California is a different situation. We will wrap this up in a few minutes. We will talk sort of broadly about the direction of the court and ask him some of the big questions that we asked of Paul Bender last week about the way the court is going and the way he sees the direction of the court. When we return in just a couple of minutes with John Hsu in the Think Tank on KTAR.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we are back. Final segment, John Hsu, constitutional attorney. We have been talking about the upcoming cases in the Supreme Court. And I'd like to kind of get your broad philosophical observations on the direction of the court. I went and I tallied the sort of the seven cases that got decided at the end of this term. And this is a court that most people expected to be a very, very solidly conservative court. And now, of course, it depends on which cases come in front of it. But there were seven cases that you could sort of look at a liberal conservative decision on it. Five of those seven came down on the quote unquote liberal side. Now, that could be the nature of the specific cases, but do you think that says anything about the direction of the court, or do you think that's just idiosyncratic, this particular set of cases?
Well, I think what it says is that the Supreme Court and how we choose our justices have really moved in the wrong direction since 1968. It used to be that Supreme Court confirmations were pretty mild events, that the Senate would look to the home state senators of the particular nominee. And in general, unless the guy was really, really unqualified, would grant the president his nominee. But since 1968, they've become these political sideshows. And it hasn't been so much about a justice's view on statutory interpretation or constitutional interpretation, but rather where the justice stands on social issues or the nominee stands on social issues. And I think that's just terrible because the Supreme Court confirmation and a Supreme Court justice should not be this predictable based on whether he or she stands a certain way on a particular social issue.
And
so I just think it's a shame.
And yeah, I mean, you look at a lot of these cases and we say, look, I see, you know, four predictable liberal votes. I see three or four predictable conservative votes. The one I'm hedging on is the Chief Justice, but 95% of the time, as Paul Bender pointed out, when it makes a decision, he says 99% of the time, when his vote is critical, he's come down on the conservative side. So basically, the gist of that is that the direction of the Supreme Court comes down to Justice Kennedy.
This is Tony Kennedy's court. There's no question about that. Ever since Justice O'Connor retired, this is Tony Kennedy's court. There's just no question about that.
And he's an interesting case in that there's a question about he was thought to be a very conservative. I think he is a very conservative jurist in general, but he is not as remotely as predictable as his compatriots on the court.
Well, I would disagree with that. I think that, when he was on the Ninth Circuit, I think he was already essentially unpredictable then. You know, Tony Kennedy was not President Reagan's first choice in 88, 89. Bob Bork was, of course. And, of course, we know what happened to Bob Bork. And then Doug
Ginsburg. Bork became a verb.
Yep, Bork became a verb, and unfortunately, Ginsburg did not become a verb. This is Doug Ginsburg, not Ruth Bader, did not become a verb for puffing on marijuana. Of course, if Judge Ginsburg, who was on the D.C. Circuit at the time, if he had been nominated today instead of 1988, I don't think anybody would care that he smoked marijuana.
Well, we have three presidents in a row who've been quite explicit about their use, inhaling
right.
or not. Then I think it's just one of those situations. I think it's generational. You know, when you got into when you got baby boomers as president, that became a laughable issue. But prior to that, when you were dealing with World War II generation, this was seen as a horrific thing that was disqualifying.
That's right. Now, I will say this. There are probably a lot of people, both liberals and conservatives, who believe that at some point Tony Kennedy was smoking marijuana when he wrote these opinions. And that's a joke, of course. I think that they really believe that.
So where do you see the court going? I mean, it's Anthony Kennedy's court until somebody else gets appointed?
Well, it depends on who that somebody is.
What direction it goes is absolutely.
Yep. And so.
Well, it also depends on not only who's appointed, but who leaves.
Yeah. And I don't think that Tony Kennedy was looking to leave the court anytime soon. I think he enjoys where he is, and I think he enjoys being the swing.
I'm not suggesting he's going to leave, but I'm suggesting that if the retiring justice were Ruth Bader Ginsburg versus Anthony Scalia, for example, the difference would be huge. I mean, if Ginsburg leaves and a Democrat appoints a successor, there's probably no change.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we can look all the way back to 1990-91. At that time, Justice Thurgood Marshall was already in his early 90s, and he did not want to retire while a Republican president was in office. But his health just gave out, and he just didn't have much of a choice. So he had to retire, and of course, President George H.W. Bush nominated Clarence Thomas, and after a very controversial confirmation process, he's now been on the court since 1991, and I think his jurisprudence has been very powerful.
Well, I'll you know a little kind of personal observation anecdote here. Some people have said, you know, Democrats have said, God, Ruth Bader Ginsburg should retire in case there's a Republican elected. I think I'm personally convinced that she's observed the case of Sandra Day O'Connor, who very much regrets having resigned from the court. And on a personal level, I think she's observed that, and she doesn't want to be that. And she's going to, as a result of that, she's been quite explicit that she's going to stay.
That's right.
So,
yeah, Justice Ginsburg has said she's not going anywhere.
We have our time is up. John Hsu, constitutional attorney, thank you very much. We got a pretty good idea where what the court's going to. We may not know what they're going to do, but we know what they're going to deal with next year. Thank you.